Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello and welcome to Off the Beat and Track Podcast. I'm your host, I'm Stu Whiffin. It's another week, therefore it's another episode. Today's episode, I sit down with actual comedy royalty. I sit with Charlie Higson. That's right. I mean, we talk about so much on this episode. We talk about his new podcast, History of the Monarchy, speaking of royalty. And we talk about his other podcast, Charlie Higson and Friends, where he gets absolute mega names in comedy on and talks to them about their life and music, and classical music essentially. And so not only am I sitting here thinking I'm about to interview an absolute comedy hero of mine, but also somebody that's got a successful music podcast. So I was very nervous. Them nerves evaporated in seconds when Charlie popped up on the screen, because he's such a nice guy and we have such a delightful chat, and I can't wait for you to hear it. It's coming your way very soon. But before we do that, we always like to do a little thank you. So my thanks first of all start with you lot, because you've been so kind with your time and you've given, 500 episodes of this podcast, your time and a lot of the time your love. I've received so many nice messages about what you get from this podcast and people that have enjoyed it, and it's really nice to get those messages. So for all of you that have supported the podcast and liked it and shared it and retweeted it and messaged me about it, thank you so much. You'd think by 500 episodes I'd be done, but I'm not. I'm having the best time. I've just interviewed Charlie Higson, for God's sake. It just keeps getting better and better. I also want to thank Scroobius Pip, because he's the guy that got me involved in this podcast in Malarkey, and it's been such a life-changing thing, and it's become such a huge part of my life and my job, and it all can be scaled back to Mr. Pippikins getting me involved. I want to thank the team at the Blue Murder Club podcast, which is another great podcast you should check out. It's a true crime pod, and the team over there produce this podcast. So big thanks to everybody at the Blue Murder Club podcast. Listen, before I get on with it, another thing. Once you've finished today's episode, if you're kind of new to it, you've missed so many episodes. And if you like your comedy, then if you like the Higsons, Charlie's band that he was in the late 70s, early 80s, I've had Terry Edwards, who was a Higson, and my chat with Terry was recorded a few years ago, and it's a delightful chat. We talk about Terry's work with Nick Cave and with Gallon Drunk and a myriad of artists, and that's a great chat. And in regards to people that make you laugh, well, I've been lucky that I've had guests like... Oh, I've also had Simon Day on. I forgot about that. Simon Day of The Fast Show. Had a great chat with Simon. But also, in the realms of stand-up, Ed Gamble, James Acaster, Jade Adams, Maisie Adam, Rhys James. So many big comedy heavyweights have swung past the studio and had a natter with me about music, and they're all there to be enjoyed for free, alongside, all your bands and musicians and DJs and producers, big super producers like Fatboy Slim and Butch Vig, and yeah, monster rock bands like The Killers and Blur and Foo Fighters and Motley Crue. They've all been on. I've had them all. And you can go and check them all out for free wherever you get your podcasts. Now, like I say, over 500. This is a labour of love, this podcast. I don't make money out of this. And the way that, you know, I can kind of help pay the team that produced this and you know, and the time that I put into to keeping these coming at you thick and fast is you can go and check out my Patreon. And it costs $1 a month. What's that? 70-something pence, I think. And that dollar, not only does it kind of, you know, express and offer a thank you for the pod, I give you loads of stuff as well. So I put up all the videos over on Patreon, so you can go watch all the episodes, should you wish. There's a huge archive over there of radio shows, mixtapes, Spotify playlists, unreleased episodes, bundles of stuff, like hundreds of them. And that dollar a month will get you access to all of that. And one thing I do each month as well is a live show. I do a little live show on Zoom and we pick a little topic and you all jump on and we have a lovely chat. Not in a kind of snobby, elitist, muso way. You know, we talk about embarrassing records. We talk about whatever song it is, if it sparks a memory or something that brings happiness, sorrow, sadness, joy, whatever. We talk about it and it's lovely and it's your opportunity to feature on an episode. I've uploaded a few so you can go and listen to them on the same place that you're listening to this. Alternatively, you can listen to them all again for your $1 a month. So yeah, so let's break that down. Hundreds of radio shows, hundreds of video episodes, massive archive of never released episodes, and a monthly live show that you can come on for 70p a month. And if you can do that, that would be wonderful. I know this is the bit that most people skip to get to the good stuff, and the good stuff's coming, trust me. But if you can take a moment and head over to Patreon, patreon.com/offthebeatandtrack, there'll be a little video you can watch for free where it's my silly face telling you all the stuff that you get. And that was recorded ages ago, so it's probably a little bit out of date now, but you get even more stuff now. So yeah, if you can spare that dollar a month, that would be amazing. Anything else you need to know about the podcast, including the Patreon, there's a one-stop shop, and that's the website, and that's Off The Beat And. It's Beat And, not Beaten. offthebeatandtrackpodcast.com. I think that's all of that bit done now, so we can get on to the good stuff. Gives me great pleasure to say this. Please enjoy Off The Beat And Track podcast with the wonderful Charlie Higson.
It's Off The Beat And Track podcast on the Distraction Pieces Network with me, Stu Whiffin.
Okay, we are recording. Charlie Higson, how are you?
I'm very good, actually, yes. How
Wonderful.
Are you?
I'm all right. Well, look, there's so much I want to talk about regarding music today, but before we do anything, let's talk about your new podcast. Because normally guests come on and they've got something, I always save it till the end, but it seems pointless. Let's just jump straight in. Tell us about the podcast.
Yeah, I've done a few of these lately, and I thought, yeah, I'll do that. That'll be fun to do, and I can talk about the podcast, and then it finishes, and I carry on with my day, and then I think, I forgot to mention the bloody podcast. I just enjoy doing them. So yes, I've taken a slight sort of sideways step into doing podcasts. Well, I'm doing a history podcast. I suppose most people might assume I would do a comedy podcast, and I've been trying to persuade Paul Whitehouse to do one with me, but he's proving reluctant at the moment. But I'm working on him. But yeah, I mean, for the past, gosh, at least 10 years or so, I've been a regular at a thing called the Chalk Valley History Festival, which is a fantastic history festival in the Chalk Valley, funnily enough, in Wiltshire. And it has brilliant, has all the top historians on. And I initially went to host a kind of comedy history quiz, which I do every year. But then I also said, well, look, while I'm here, I'll do a talk. So I've been delving into history, and I got interested when I was at school in the 1960s, back in the days when history was still taught as a sort of narrative thing of kings and queens and great men and battles. I was taught a rhyme, Willy Willy Harry Stee Harry Dick John Harry III, etc., which is the monarchy from William I to the present day. And during lockdown, I kind of got into it. I thought, I'm going to learn who these people were, just to keep myself occupied. Yeah. And I thought, well, this is such a mad and interesting story. I will share it with the world. So that's what I'm doing. It's an old school narrative history. We start with William the Conqueror, and I will end sometime next year with Charles III.
And people can get that wherever they get their podcasts, right?
Wherever you get your podcast, there it is, called Willy Willy Harry Stee.
Wonderful, wonderful. We'll put the link to it in the show notes to this show, so excellent. When people finish listening to this, they can head over and check it out. I did also see that you dabbled in podcasting, and there were some music-based podcasts that you'd done previously.
Yes, I have. They started as... it was a sort of irregular series I've been doing on Scala Radio, which is a fairly new classical music station. It's kind of, a rival to Classic FM. They're trying to aim for a slightly younger audience, which means they're aiming at the sort of 50-year-olds.
Yeah.
But I've always, I've always been interested in classical music, and it is kind of my first love. And I know on this podcast it's kind of like, what was the first music I bought, and it was mostly classical. I was a terrible nerd when I was a teenager, but I do love classical music. So I have a show on Scala Radio, which I do occasionally, called Charlie Higson and Friends, where I talk to friends about classical music, but it's wider than that, because the remit on Scala is wider. So it's not just classical, it's film music, it's, music from games, from TV shows, anything really using the sort of setup of a classical orchestra, as it were. And so many people, say, I don't really listen to any classical music. And then you say, well, have you watched any films recently?
Yeah.
Because essentially, that's a lot of that is an orchestra. And, a lot of people do listen to soundtrack music. Again, most of the early albums I bought alongside classical and jazz was soundtrack albums. So, I've had obvious people like Paul Whitehouse and Harry Enfield and Amanda Iannucci, Lucy Porter, Arabella Weir. So that people I know who... And Bob Mortimer, who freely confessed that he doesn't really listen to any classical music, but with a bit of probing, we found out there were bits of music that he liked and bits from films that he'd liked and stuff. So, but it's mainly a way of talking to someone. The great thing about it is the actual shows, when they go out, are like 2 hours long, and you so rarely get the chance, even in real life, to talk to any of my friends for that long. Yeah. But to do it on the radio is great, and just to share music. So I play some of my favourite tracks, and they play something else. And having done some, Scala said, "Well, let's put this out as a podcast." So yes, it's available there. That might be slightly harder to get hold of. I'm not sure that's available on all platforms. You might have to go through the Scala Radio app.
Okay, well, we find that the show notes we pop that in the show notes as well.
Right.
Well, let's start your playlist today. And and Charlie, I'm going to ask you first to tell me the song that you regard as having the greatest ever intro, please.
That's such a difficult question, isn't it?
Everyone says that. Everyone says this is a tough one.
Well, because there are so many, and there are so many great intros that come on, and you think, oh, yes, I love this. Mm. And, I could have gone for a bombastic one, like Born to Run or something by Bruce Springsteen. But actually, I do prefer music that is a little more... I'm not laid back, but I like music that's quite sort of casual and relaxed. I don't really go for the sort of big soul belters, that sort of X Factor style of singing where why sing one note when you can sing 12?
Yeah.
And everything is just passionate and blaring at you. I like things which are understated, and I like it when it's just a really great bunch of musicians come together. They all know exactly what they're doing. It's like, okay, now let's get into the groove. And I think a perfect example of that, and I chose it because I've been listening to it quite a lot recently, is Love and Happiness by Al Green. You know, at his peak, those songs were just, they were just so in control. And again, he, you know, he's an understated singer.
Yeah.
You know, he enjoys singing. He's a great singer, but he's not wailing and bellowing. And the intro for this is very, it's very simple. I mean, there's an extended bit where he's kind of getting into it and the guitar's noodling a bit. And then it's like the drummer says, okay, let's go for it. And I do like an intro that starts with a drum beat. I was toying with Like a Rolling Stone. Again, one of the most famous opening snare beats in history.
No one chose that, Charlie. I've done 500
really,
of these.
Well, maybe they think it's too like obvious. I don't know, because it, you know, it kind of announces, you know, not just the song, but it's a kind of like a new style of music for Bob Dylan and everything. It's like, okay, this is going to be something new. Also, Sound and Vision. You see, that starts with a great, great drum beat, the sort of synthetic drums. But the Al Green, Love and Happiness, is just, the drummer says, okay, here we go, tap, tap. And then everything just falls into that amazing groove. And the rest of the song carries on and it's fine.
Yeah.
And occasionally they think, well, let's do the intro again because that's the best bit. But no, it's a fabulous piece of music.
You said that you've been listening to that and Al Green recently. Where do you listen to music?
Well, I work from home. I have a studio, which I am in at the moment. And I've always worked from home. And for years, I thought, well, I can't listen to music when I'm writing, because it would be a distraction. But then I thought, well, I'm sat at this desk for like 8 hours a day or whatever. And I kind of tried to do office hours. And, you know, I did have a good audio set into the computer, but I wouldn't use it when I was writing. But I thought, I've got to work out a way of actually that I can listen to music, because, you know, it's my office. My wife was not working from home, so I was just me by myself all day. I could blare out music as loud as I wanted. So I start, and this was back before Spotify, I started putting together sort of playlists on iTunes. And it was mainly starting with classical or film soundtrack music, stuff without vocals, stuff that it wasn't going to kind of interfere with me, but could act. And it really came together for me when I started writing a series of young James Bond books. I wanted to put some music on that would get me into the right frame of mind for writing and could act in a way as a soundtrack to what I was writing. So, you know, I put together a Bond playlist. I've got loads of Bond soundtrack albums and obviously start with the James Bond theme, kick it off, and away you go. And it worked fantastically well. And what I realized was, because I will usually have two or three different projects on at once, is I'll put together a different playlist for each one. So I can switch. My head gets in the right place. So I might be, you know, back in then those days, I might have been doing, you know, young James Bond in the morning, something else in the afternoon with a completely different playlist. And you hit the different playlist and your mind is instantly in the right place. And I found that I it worked really well and I really enjoyed it. And I put together a sort of general writing playlist for any project, which has actually got a lot of Philip Glass on it. A lot of writers say they listen to Philip Glass when they're working.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because I think it's because of the music. The pieces tend to be quite long, and quite repetitive, and because it's a sort of sequential music or whatever, there's not a lot of sudden blaring, loud bits, and then quiet bits, and then a fast bit, and then a slow bit. It tends to be slowly kind of unfolding and revolving, and it sort of mirrors one's sort of brain patterns, I think, when you're writing. So Philip Glass is brilliant to write to. I mean, all my playlists are there. You know, once I got, well, you know, once Spotify became a thing, I started making them on Spotify because I had unlimited choice of stuff, and they're all there if anyone wants to check them out and listen to them. So now I can happily listen to music all day long.
Fantastic. Well, let's get back to this list, and for track two. Could you tell me, please, the first song that you remember hearing that had an emotional impact on you, please, Charlie?
Well, emotional is it's a wide range, isn't it? Mm. From happiness to sorrow via whatever's in the middle, and whether that even is an emotion, I don't know. For emotional music, I would normally turn to kind of classical music. I mean, for me, the most emotional piece that I find the most moving is probably the Liebestod from Wagner's Tristan and Isolde opera, which sounds terribly poncy and highfalutin. It's the love death. It's basically Isolde dying out of sort of ecstasy in some ways. It's a very long orgasm. It is a very beautiful piece of music, but I've gone with actual more, in the realm of pop music. It's a very broad church. I mentioned it just now. It's the James Bond theme by John Barry, because definitely as a little kid, hearing that for the first time in the cinema was completely emotionally overwhelming. It was the most exciting thing, and you know, it instantly transports you into this world of glamour and sex and excitement and people being cool. So as a small boy, that's the sort of emotion that you want. You don't want something to make you sad.
Absolutely.
I suppose there were things. Well, it made me happy. Mm. So it made me very, very happy and excited. So yes, a very extreme emotion. And it's a type of music because, you know, it's the music you listen to when you're young that stays with you through your life, that you do have the closest emotional connection with, because you're hearing these things for the first time and you're going through so much in your life for the first time. And so any kind of musical accompaniment to that takes on a much deeper emotional value than anything I can hear now as an old man. Although as you do get older, there are some pieces of music that you dismissed as a young person. Mm. And now you're thinking, oh, I get it now.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Two questions. Where was you at this point? Where was growing up? And was home musical?
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term medical plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term medical plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Wow!
Nice!
Yeah!
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Yeah, I lived in a giant music box. and my father would get up in the mornings and turn the handle.
Do you come out like Camberwick Green?
Yes. Life would have been so much simpler if that was the case. I'm a very sort of dull, straight down the line, sort of middle class product of the home counties. As a small boy, I was mostly in Crawley in Sussex. Then we moved to Sevenoaks in Kent. My father worked in the city, wore a bowler hat. He was an accountant and he commuted. And we lived in a very nice, we were just outside Sevenoaks, sort of in very rural. And those are when most of my strong memories are from. Yeah. But the prep school I was at, where I learnt the Willy Willy Harry Steer rhyme, was a little one called Font Hill near Tunbridge, which in the words of Rob Reiner in Spinal Tap, Don't look for it. It isn't there anymore. it was one, there were hundreds and hundreds of these kind of prep schools back in the sort of early mid 20th century, which I think they'd all sort of sprung up to, well, they serviced the public schools, which had been set up largely to train the children of empire, really, to give them the education they need, and so they could board there if they, you know, their parents were abroad or whatever. And yeah, most of those prep schools are gone now. But this very eccentric little place, run by a man called Mr. Carter, who I assumed owned it as well. So it was his own little kingdom there. And yeah, you know, I've got good memories of those days, but it was all reasonably sort of straightforward and straight down the line, and as I say, very middle class. But what's wrong with that?
Nothing. Was there a record player at home?
Oh, yes. No, a musical family. Yeah, we did. I mean, my father, he never had he wasn't one of those kind of, I'm going to get a really fancy hi-fi set. It's really interesting. I read, when I travel, if I've got long flights, I always buy like one of the old school music magazines, which I'm amazed. Every time I go to the airport, I think, well, it must have shut down by
it's
now.
It's the only time I buy them as well, Charlie.
Yeah, it's like Mojo and
Q.
Uncut.
Yeah.
Yes, Q. And they kind of take turns to interview the same people. But what I find fascinating about it, because I didn't really pay attention at the time, so I was never really into sort of pop and rock music, but it's reading about all those old bands who, as you were sort of aware, were out there, people like Buffalo Springfield and names like that, but never really knew who they were or listened to any of their music. So finding out the stories of these I find quite interesting. But so many of them, you know, they mention the fact that, you know, in the, I guess it was probably more towards the late 60s and into the 70s, if you were a bloke, you got the best hi-fi setup you could get your hands on. That was the most important thing to have in your living room, was a great amp, a really good turntable, top quality needle, and some huge speakers. And, you know, that's how you listen to music. And music does sound amazing with that setup. But now, kids, despite the fact that you've got access to technology that can play stuff for you, they don't seem to be interested. I mean, obviously, there is a sort of slight hipsterist thing with vinyl and turntables, but most kids, you know, they'll be playing music off their phone, and they won't even bother to put it through a speaker. They'll just play it off the phone on the table, or that, you know, they'll have a obviously they listen to headphones quite a lot. Or again at their computers, but the idea of having a really good hi-fi setup in the home doesn't really seem to be important to people, which I think is a shame. But yeah, I mean, my dad wasn't one of those blokes who needed a really good hi-fi setup. I remember he came home one day and he was very proud. He bought this unit that kind of did everything, including it had an 8-track.
Amazing.
Cartridge slot in it. Not that we had any 8-tracks, and he never bought one. But you could get an adapter and put a cassette player into an 8-track adapter and shove that in. So it worked as a tape player and a radio and a turntable. So it was everything all in one box. So it was really pretty crappy with two little speakers. But he seemed happy about that. But then he did upgrade, because in later life he started getting into classical music. And we had an okay setup in the living room, and I really got into classical music. And I'd get home from school and I'd move the speakers on the floor and lie between them with them facing at me and play things like Wagner, loud classical music, the sort of heavy metal side of classical music,
yeah.
which was great. But, you know, I mean, my father had this set of records, a few classical records. He didn't have any pop or rock. Excuse me. So I'm not doing one of my carrots. he didn't have any pop or rock. I remember once he and my mum had a party. The only party I remember them ever having. And so they needed to get some music for it. So they bought one album. And it was by a band called Sounds Incorporated.
Yeah.
Do you know who Sounds Incorporated were?
Did they do the Dawn of Aquarius?
No. Oh, God, who was that? No, that was... That'll come to me. No, it Sounds Incorporated were essentially session musicians.
Right.
And they basically, any time an American, you know, rock and roll act would come over, they wouldn't afford to bring a band with them, so that they would use English musicians and Sounds Incorporated with the kind of go-to setup. They're sort of musicians who could play anything and everything. And they did a couple of albums of instrumentals, cover versions mostly of things at the time. So that was...
How did that go down at the Do?
Well, you know, they would play one side, then play the other, then go back and play the first side again. So, yeah, I mean, it was quite funny. But I then inherited the album and I played it to death. Their first album is brilliant. And it had a few kind of sort of pop versions of classical music on.
Yeah.
Like the William Tell Overture, for instance. It was quite like the Shadows, who I think also, they also played sort of backup to other people, didn't they? Lots of twangy guitar, which I liked as a kid. I guess because it all sounded like James Bond. But my brother, luckily I had an older brother, my oldest brother. My second brother was more into kind of prog rock and Genesis, which I never got into. But my oldest brother had quite a good record collection. And again, it was slightly eclectic. I don't know what you would describe that sort of early 70s people like Family and Faust and... you know, it's Pink Floyd, you know, veering away from what he would have seen as commercial stuff. Well, I won't say the other one because I think it's the answer to my next question.
Okay.
Maybe we should move on to that.
Let's do that because we're talking about those formative years. So tell me, Charlie, the song that reminds you of your time at school, please.
Well, the album of my brother's that I really got into most and that I listened to over and over again and would instantly take me back to those years, so I sort of early teenage years, was The Velvet Underground and Nico, which just kind of spoke to me. You know, it's quite sort of straightforward. There's not a lot of, well, there's experimental showing off, but it's not like, let's do a drum solo, let's do a guitar solo. The drum's basically more, Mo Tucker just starts up with a rhythm and carries on till the end of the song and then stops, which for me was perfect. And it all tended to be quite sort of repetitive. And for me, as this sort of, as I say, sort of nerdy middle-class schoolboy in commuter district in Kent, listening to that album transported me to a much more dark and exciting world of kind of New York in the early 70s, with all these kind of freaks and weirdos and lots of sex and drugs. And it was so different to my life. And I suppose it sort of gave me a sort of a yearning and a desire to move on. And the track that I played over and over again was Waiting for the Man.
Yeah.
Again, absolutely out of anything I'd experienced. I'd never had to walk up to a brownstone in New York and go in with all these weird people and find my dealer. Yeah. I just went to the local pub underage and drank brown ale.
You're talking about your brother's record collection and obviously listening to like the Velvets and stuff. Was the people that you was going to school with immersed in that sort of music, or were they, you know, was you never sort of drawn to any of the kind of more shiny commercial pop that was probably on Top of the Pops? And
no, I mean, you know, the people I hung out with were more the kind of arty type who, you know, who would turn their back on all that, as my elder brother did. And those are the people I was drawn to, and actually the sort of focal point of I went to Sevenoaks School, which is a sort of public school. But it had an absolutely amazing art department run by this incredibly inspiring guy called Bob White. And he taught art, but he also taught about life and ways of looking at the world and ways of understanding. And, you know, I learned so much more in the art department than I did anywhere else at school. And one of the other things they had there was a record player and a record collection that the kids over the years would bring in stuff. And, you know, after school, I'd hang out there and a lunch hour, I'd hang out in there. And even during lessons, they would be playing some of this music. So there was lots of Bob Dylan there. and you know, listening to Bob Dylan always takes me back to those days. And you know, lots of albums which were very similar. I mean, like the Velvet Underground, similar to what my brother was playing. You know, it was kind of anti-pop. But isn't that slightly snobbish, sort of? Grey was a test kind of world. you know, it was kind of like albums, not singles, and you know, you mustn't watch Top of the Pops. Although I did watch Top of the Pops because of Pants People. but you know, it's amazing. You know, out of the that art department, lots of musicians came out of there. Half the Gang of Four came out of that art department.
Oh, really?
And the Mekons. In fact, one of the Mekons was Bob White's son. So, you know, that period in the mid-70s where everything... I mean, it's extraordinary when you think about 70s music. You had all these things coming together. You've got heavy metal becoming a thing, which, again, that was an English, British thing, largely, as it started. You had glam rock. You had disco. You had pub rock, which was, you know, a really big thing in the mid-70s.
And I think it's... and then you fast forward just a couple of years, and I love watching the kind of retrospective episodes of Top of the Pops now. And a few months ago, they had one from 79 on. And you've got, like, the kind of emerging sort of post-punk scene. You've got the tail end of, like, a kind of... I don't know, lots of mohawks and shitty punk, really, that sort of come from
good
there.
Good punk didn't last very long, did it?
but then you've also got the sort of disco, and then you've got Two Tone, and you've got the stuff that was happening on, like, Stiff and things like that. And it was, like, it was such an exciting time for music.
It was, yeah. I mean, you know, and amazingly tribal as well, that you would have to sort of nail your colours to the type of music you liked, and then... You might then find, I prefer that stuff over there. I wish I could listen to some of that.
but I've already bought the clothes.
Yeah, there was so much, you know, there was so much going on through the 70s. And then, and obviously, you know, that huge punk explosion, which the good part of it went into Two Tone. But yeah, there was a lot that you could say, right, this is my music, I'm going with this. And it was all feeding into each other, and that rivalry between all the stuff was really creative. And so out of that mid-70s period, you know, starting with pub rock and then moving into punk rock, that idea of what, you know, it's been overdone, but, you know, you can do it for yourself. And everybody wanted to start a band. I think there'd been a bit of that in the early 60s, in the 60s when the whole guitar group thing started. But I don't know what had happened slightly in the early 70s, but certainly from the mid-70s, everybody was wanting to be part of this.
Well, you was, right?
I did, yes. I mean, I went to, I took a year out, then I went to Norwich, home of rock and roll, in 1977, where I met Paul Whitehouse. We gravitated towards each other because we were two of the few people at university who wore straight jeans. I've tried to explain this to my kids. I've said, and they said, because, you know, they thought that only a few people wore flares. They thought that was, some hippies. You know, if you're a hippie, if you're an outsider, you wore flares. It's hard to get across that everybody wore flares. Mm. Even businessmen wore flared trousers with their suits. Mm. And if you wore straight jeans, you'd be chased around and beaten up as some kind of aberrant figure. So yes, at university, those few people who wore straight jeans got together and we formed a punk band in Norwich called the Right Hand Lovers, which didn't last very long because Paul and most of the rest of the band were thrown out of university for not doing any work. and punk had kind of died by that point anyway. And I formed another band, which eventually became the Higgsons, which is what I did. Which is what I did for 5 or 6 years after leaving university. I was a professional singer.
I had been watching you on the television for many years and had no idea that you had this, this previous career. And I discovered that the Higgsons in a really bizarre way. I was a huge, huge REM fan. And they'd done a secret show at the Borderline in 1991 under the name of Bingo Handjob. And and Billy Bragg was on stage with them, and Robin Hitchcock was on stage with them.
Right, okay.
And I was hearing Michael Stipe singing this song called Listening to the Hicksons, and I was like, what's this? And then when I found Robin Hitchcock, and then subsequently. And what was so weird was, at this point, I was going to watch Gallon Drunk all the time. And so I had no idea that Terry, who's also a lovely gentleman, has been on this podcast a few times.
Oh, brilliant.
And had no idea that Terry was also in the Hicksons.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a very bizarre way of finding
Well,
finding
I mean,
music.
You know, I think more people know us from the Robin Hitchcock song than know us from actually going to see us. And you know, probably like you, most of them have no idea what the Hicksons were. Mm. And I've seen a couple of things where the people have done sort of spin-off things where the Hicksons are sort of like this sort of weird, they've imagined them as being sort of a weird sort of Illuminati type of organization. But no, we were a sort of scratchy punk funk outfit from Norwich.
I mean, it's quite interesting that you sort of done it in a different way to lots of other people that in the comedy industry. If I was sort of thinking about this earlier, sort of in the drive-in this morning, if you look at Vic and Bob, and you look at Coogan, and you look at Peter Kay and Lee Evans, all of these people established themselves in comedy and then pursued this little sort of side hustle as entertaining themselves with this kind of, I want to be a musician, I want to just tick that box. And you've done it the other way around.
Well, I did it the proper way around, yes.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's great to do when you're a young man or a young woman. Get it out of your system, you know, do the whole rock and roll thing.
Yeah.
But that was what gave me a love of performing to an audience. Although I never wanted to do that as comedy. But I mean, you know, in 1977, if you wanted to get on stage and ask about and impress your mates and get off with girls, if you're a man or a woman, you'd form a band.
Yeah.
And that's what Paul and I did. It didn't cross our minds for one second that we might have thought, hey, let's do a comedy act. Mm. What? Are you nuts? But it's funny, Harry Enfield being that bit younger than us, when he was at university, forming a comedy act was a thing. Mm. And that's what he did. And he's probably one of those comedians who had a hankering. I really wish I had been in a band. I mean, a lot of them, you know, I mean, like, you know, Vic Reeves did have a band when he was when he was younger. He dabbled in that world. And funny enough, when I was still at Norwich, and it must have been about 1980. There was a sort of night of music and entertainment, which did include comedy, and it was Rick Mayall and Ade Edmondson. I don't think, were they the Dangerous Brothers? So it was whatever their comedy act was before they were on TV.
Yeah, it's the Dangerous
and,
Brothers.
And, you know, saw a bit of that and thought, oh, that's interesting, some comedy there. And then went next door to watch some long forgotten musical act. But yes, well, there's me and there's Ricky Gervais, who did it when we were young.
Absolutely. And I mean, like you, I got into music to ask about on stage, to quote you, and to meet girls. Bizarrely, my band was managed by Ricky Gervais in a very strange about way that's just possible. But what I did want to say was, with that in mind, that, you know, you kind of sort of mock it a little bit of like you was just asking about on stage, but that's still no easy thing to do. So I just want to kind of get a measure of what you was like at that age. Was you a confident young man?
Well, I've always been very shy. But, you know, I think you find a lot of actors, I mean, I don't really class myself as an actor, but I think a lot of actors are very shy. And people say to them, well, how can you go on stage in front of all those people? And say, well, it's not me going on stage, it's the character I'm playing.
Yeah.
And, you know, I might be playing a super confident character, in which case I'll be super confident on stage. and it'll be quite fun. I mean, for me, you know, like playing someone like Swiss Tony, and we've done Fast Show live.
Yeah.
If you do that live on stage, I'm Swiss Tony and I'm there pontificating to an audience, which is much harder to do going out as Charlie Higson. Although, you know, I think a lot of people have said, you know, it's easier to talk to a room of 1,000 people than a room of 5 people, because a crowd is an entity, whereas 5 people are 5 different people, and you're thinking, well, what are they thinking about me?
Yeah.
Or they're not paying attention, or they've gone to sleep.
Yeah.
So I did, you know, I've always enjoyed that aspect of performing, of being able to sort of step outside of being myself and being someone else on stage. And the great thing about being in a band is it's not just you standing there. You've got a huge rack of amps and some very loud drums, yeah, and other people to take the stick. So what was the question again?
No, we've kind of got to the end of that question. I was just about confidence. And,
confidence performing. I mean, I said before, you know, I got a love of being on stage, and it's what's great about being in a band is you've got a direct connection with your audience. You know, if say you've written a new song, you can play it for the first time to an audience and gauge what they're thinking. And you know, writing a book is not like that.
Yeah.
You very rarely meet the people who read it, and you know, you might do a reading in at an event or something, but it's not the same. And that's what I like. You know, when we were doing comedy in the 90s, Paul and I started, the first thing that we wrote for was Saturday Night Live. We were writing for Harry. We were doing Stavros and Loads of Money, and that was live in front of an audience. Yeah. It was like a you know, it had a sort of rock energy to it. And, you know, we could work on something during the week. It moved to Friday quite quickly. And then on the Friday night, we'd go to the show as punters almost. And our material would be going out. I mean, Harry had the tough job of actually being there live on stage, live on TV, doing this stuff. And you could hear people laughing at your jokes. And that was an amazing feeling. And then when we did Harry Enfield television program and then the Fast Show, we would record the bigger, more obvious stuff, I suppose. We would record in a studio with a live audience.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's this thing now, people going about, oh, it's got canned laughter. Well, no, canned laughter is something very specific. Canned laughter is when you haven't recorded it with an audience, but you're sticking laughter on. Mm. Famously, growing up, it was things like the Flintstones, where you're thinking, people are laughing at a cartoon. They weren't there when this was performed.
I've never thought about
it. And you would start to recognize some of the laughs. but, you know, we got that energy from the audience, and you get that instant feedback of whether something is funny or not. You know, where you need to put a bit more work in and stuff. So I loved that, that aspect of it. And it's a shame that it's kind of fallen out of fashion for TV comedy.
Yeah.
You get it on chat shows
and
stuff like that. But most comedy now is, you know, it's all single camera, two people in a flat talking about their relationship.
Yeah.
The biggest names in tennis are coming to Paris for the most anticipated Roland Garros in years. Tennis Channel Plus is your place to watch. Stream every court from your phone or smart TV live in HD. Experience 3 weeks of unparalleled tournament access as the world's top players in tennis face off against each other. Will the veteran champions continue their dominance, or will a fresh face emerge to challenge their legacy on the clay courts? Daily live coverage of this epic showdown begins Monday, May 20th. Don't miss a matchup. Stream it now with Tennis Channel Plus to be there when it happens.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
I'm going to ask you to tell me the first song you remember buying from a record shop, please, Charlie.
Well, as I was saying before, the first stuff I remember buying was albums. The first album I bought was a Fats Waller album. And it was actually, and because I never really got into pop in the 70s, I wasn't sort of buying the latest David Bowie or Sweet or whoever. I only really started buying singles when, you know, in the second half of the 70s, where you suddenly have, you know, labels like Stiff Records, and you think, oh, I want one of those. That's a collector's item. And so you'd start, you know, I'd buy a lot of the early stuff. And I can't remember exactly the very first one I bought, but amongst the first records I ever bought was England's Glory by Max Wall, which is a song that Ian Dury wrote for him. And the early Stiff Records was so interesting.
Yeah.
Was that transition from pub rock to punk rock, and it sort of solidified into one thing as punk rock. But in that sort of interim period, there was just this sort of weird mix of stuff, and particularly that they were doing on something like Stiff Records, a lot of quite diverse acts, including people like, you know, Ian Dury, who amazingly was sort of seen as a punk artist, although there's, apart from his attitude, there's not really a lot of punk in there. There's no punk in there. You know, they were quite a tight jazz funk outfit,
completely.
The Blockheads. And obviously, you know, Sex and Drugs and Rock and Roll was one of the early singles I bought. But the Max Wall one, I must have heard it on John Peel or the like. But I just thought, that's a fantastic record. And it's got everything that's great about Ian Dury. It's a really well put together lyric. And it's about Englishness. And it's all these sort of cultural icons and cultural references, a lot of which will mean nothing to a young audience to today. But at the time, for me, that was the kind of summation of my life at that point, what it had meant to me. There's a reference to Mr. Pastry in it, who was this, he was a sort of pantomime act, a music hall act, never really transferred to TV. But I remember going to see a pantomime, must have been mid-60s. With Mr. Pastry in it, they used to, you know, between scenes as they were setting things up, you'd get the sort of comedy routine. And he had a wallpapering act, which he'd probably done for like 20 years unchanged.
Yeah.
Because it hadn't been on TV. So a lot of people were seeing it for the first time. But, you know, it was a slapstick act trying to hang some wallpaper. And it stuck with me. And so it was great, you know, hearing the Max Wall song.
I'd never
with
heard
a reference
that,
to Mr. Pastry.
I'd never,
you know,
heard,
I heard
that
it before.
Well. No, and I went and sort of had a look at it, and then I was like, okay, and then I didn't realise it was on Stiff, and then ended up going down this huge hole just
yes,
looking like watching Max Wall on YouTube, and then also just,
oh, he was extraordinary,
exploring Stiff again, and
yeah.
I don't know if Dave Robinson's ever wrote a book or if there's a documentary available on Stiff, but honestly,
really
as a label,
be,
it's phenomenal.
And that really was the area that I was interested in. You know, the sort of once hard punk. Yeah, there was. I bought some of the stuff, but I liked the more sort of arty, the Fringes stuff.
Mm.
You know, more the Ian Dury side of it than the Exploited.
Yeah.
Or Slaughtering the Dogs.
Yeah.
Or whatever. But I mean, you know, once you know that England's Glory was written by Ian Dury, it all makes sense.
Yeah.
And I'm pretty sure that it's probably the nucleus of the Blockheads playing. It's certainly Davey Payne playing the saxophone. You know, the solo on it is absolutely unmistakably him.
Yeah. I'm going to ask you now, I'm going to sort of fast forward to going out and about and ask you to tell me the song that soundtracked your years going clubbing.
Yes, I saw this on the list and I thought, that's a bit presumptuous. Do I look like the sort of person who spent years clubbing? And I'm not really. I've never liked clubs or music festivals. I don't like crowds particularly. And, you know, the equivalent for me in the 70s when I was a teenager was discos. Hmm. And it's interesting because there's a lot of stuff about discos now where, and this is mainly from the American perspective, where they're saying disco is this amazing thing. And, you know, it was... It was open to everyone. It was all about love and happiness and, you know, black people, gay people, drag acts, whatever. You know, disco is just peace and love and people having a beautiful time. It was not like that in the suburban discos of England in the mid-70s. Mm. Essentially, if you wanted a fight, you'd go to a disco. Mm. All the lads went to the discos and it wasn't like Saturday Night Fever where they're all drawn together by dancing in unison. Yeah. No, they would basically just be getting drunk and hitting each other.
Yeah.
So I largely kept out of discos. I didn't fit in. And then during the 80s, you know, for the first half of the 80s, I was in a band and we were playing all these. England, the UK, then had a lot of these sort of mid-sized clubs that bands could play at. Obviously, you know, the bread and butter tended to be the university, the college circuit or whatever, because they would always pay too much because it was some student organizing it. But there were still lots of clubs around the place and places to play live. For a band of our stature, where, you know, we got quite big, but we never moved up to play the really big clubs. But you could make a good living just playing the sort of mid-sized ones. But then as the 80s went on, more and more of them stopped doing live bands because they could see, you know, you put the Higgsons on a Thursday night, you get 100 people turn up. You don't put the Higgsons on a Thursday night, you get someone playing some records. You'll get 500 people turning up.
Yeah.
And the economics of that is pretty straightforward.
Yeah.
You know, we played the it is called The Factory, isn't it, in Manchester?
There was the factory that was the first Wilson-owned one, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
So, we played I was thinking, no, that's the Andy Warhol thing in New York, but it's the same thing.
Yeah.
Now, we did go to New York. You know, we played all the sort of obvious places in New York, like the Wag and the Peppermint Lounge. And,
oh, really?
Yeah, all the big places in New York. We had a brief time when we were sort of on the verge of being quite big. And if you had a record that had been picked up somewhere, and New York was the sort of place that did pick up that kind of stuff, you know, you could go and play these places. You'd go and stay in the Hotel Iroquois with about six other English musical acts who were slightly hard up.
But then
you know, we saw that all these places were stopping to do live music, and there were fewer and fewer places that would put us on. It's one of the reasons we stopped doing it. And by that point I was sort of 26, and I was thinking, well, you know, that I'm too old for rock and roll. Things have changed since then. And I didn't really want to embark on taking lots of drugs and going to all these clubs. I thought, oh, Christ, I did that in my late teen years. I didn't realize that these clubs were all full of middle-aged people off their tits on ecstasy or whatever.
I love that you're completely writing yourself off at 26. Nah,
well, I know. Well, that's what it felt at the time. You know, even by sort of 22, you think, oh, I'm a bit old for this. You know, you look at someone like Madness. They, you know, they started when they were 16.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, so, but I didn't like, I still don't see the appeal of going to, oh, there's a star DJ on.
Yeah.
What does a star DJ do? He's going to put some records on.
Yeah.
You know, it might be a bit of a light show and they might wave their hands in the air a bit and exhort you to party harder. But it was not for me. So I didn't really get into clubbing at all. I missed out on that completely. The whole clubbing scene, the rave scene, even the sort of, you know, as I say, the music festival scene, I just didn't get into it. It wasn't for me. Mm. But if I had, the one act who I really love is Fatboy Slim. Mm. And, you know, he went through, you know, and Norman had been through a very similar sort of musical arc through the 80s that we did, with a sort of indie band who is sort of fun and entertaining and not trying to be the Smiths or whatever. And then, you know, he sort of reached a stage of thinking, what do I do now? Where do I go with this? By the late 80s, I was starting to get into comedy and thinking, actually, I like this.
Yeah.
And he got into the whole club scene. And you know, I think his records are really well done. They're really interesting. He's got such an interesting range of music that he's putting into them. That's feeding into that. And I love all his stuff. And my favorite track of his is Gangster Tripping, which we used on the Farso, actually. He allowed us to use it. We did a parody of the sort of Guy Ritchie style English gangster film called It's a Right Royal Cockney Barrel of Monkeys. And we did a sort of fake trailer for that using Gangster Tripping, which worked really well. And then when we started to do the Farce Show live, we used that piece of music as the sort of play on music for Paul's Chris the Crafty Cockney. He's Cockney geezer who just basically nicks everything. And I always remember, because during these live shows, you'd be at the side getting into another costume and putting a wig on or something as quickly as you could. And whenever that music came on, it really lifted me and it lifted the audience. And I just think it's a fabulous piece of music.
Superb. I'm going to take you home now and ask you for track six.
I've been out too long.
You have. can you tell me, please, Charlie, a favourite song from an artist from your home county, please?
Home county.
Don't worry, Charlie. I've done 500 of these episodes, and you're probably the 490th person to have that exact response. I need to put county in big bold letters.
I know. I was thinking England. That's a fairly wide choice.
Yeah.
However, home county. I mean, is David Bowie? Is he technically from Kent or South London? Would you say?
I'd probably say South London, but I mean,
he lived in Kent for a while.
Right. Okay, that's good. If you want to talk Bowie, let's talk Bowie.
Yeah, I'm going to, because I can't think. I mean, who the bloody hell's from Kent? That's a good pub quiz question. Yeah. Name five acts from Kent.
Was one of the Stones not from Kent?
Well, they all sort of, all of that lot were in that sort of slight suburban outer London ring, weren't they?
Yeah.
Yeah, where?
I'll let you have Bowie.
Let's say David Bowie lived in Kent for a while.
He's definitely been there.
Well, I'm going to go with a track that I mentioned before, mainly because it was a toss-up for the best intro, and I did mention it before, Sound and Vision, which I think is a fabulous piece of music. And I remember hearing that. And again, I think I probably first heard that on John Peel when it came out in the 70s. And I just thought the sound of it was amazing. And one of the things I really like about David Bowie is I'm not into lyrics at all. I'm hopeless on a lyric round.
That surprises me as a writer.
I don't... Yeah, because I for me, music is what it sounds like and the feel of it. And you know, David Bowie and Bob Dylan have a sort of similarity in that you can listen to the songs, you think, this is kind of about something, but I don't really know what.
Yeah.
And I can impose my own meaning on it, and it can mean whatever I want it to. And for the same reason, I listen to a lot of world music, because I'm not constantly being bombarded. You see, most pop music has one meaning, and it's quite specific. And, you know, once you've heard that once, you don't want to keep being reminded that someone's in love or they've just broken up.
Yeah.
You think, well, stop telling me that over and over again.
Yeah.
But David Bowie, you know, people, oh, amazing lyrics. But, you know, he freely confessed himself that, you know, he's writing things on bits of paper and cutting them up, sticking them together. Well, that sounds good. And I've always assumed, actually, that the line blue, blue, electric blue, because I know a lot of the times when he would be like in the studio working with the musicians, putting the songs together, they do things like play over existing songs and sort of noodle around and make their own stuff up. But also, and it's a thing that a lot of songwriters do in bands, is you just sing any old gibberish that comes into your head to start with. And I've always assumed that he started out by singing the old SO Blue advert. Blue, blue, SO Blue.
Yeah.
And then just changed SO to electric because it's quite similar. But yeah, I mean, I've got no idea what Sound and Vision is about. And I don't want to be told if it does have a meaning.
It's fantastic, isn't it?
It is. And the sound of it is just extraordinary.
It's the payoff you get when that synth line drops. It keeps you, you've got to wait for the intro to really get going before that comes. Yeah. And when it does, it's beautiful.
Yeah, and I mean, I don't like a lot of synthetic music, but there's a feel to this.
Yeah.
It's not just pushing buttons.
Yeah,
it just has an atmosphere and a mood and you know, it's beautiful and alluring, but also there's a sort of slightly weird queasy edge to it as well.
Yeah.
He's definitely someone who's taken too many drugs.
Absolutely.
And, you know, listening to it, you know, as we were saying before about music taking you back, I can remember I first heard this in the bath in my house in Kent, listening to the radio, and it came on. I thought, that is amazing. Fantastic. And a brilliant intro, which starts with drums.
Yeah, absolutely. Charlie, it's your last track. And for this, you get to be a tastemaker or influencer, as the kids are calling it.
I'm not sure I'm gonna change most people's taste with this. As I just mentioned, I listen to a huge amount of world music, and in fact, you know, even as a teenager in the 70s, I really loved. My brother had a double album called the Nonesuch Explorer. Nonesuch, a great record label that do a lot of stuff from all around the world, and this was a sort of compilation. So four sides. There was one side of like Indian music, one of African, one of South American and Mexican, and one of kind of European folk music. And I listened to that over and over again, and I've always listened to world music ever since, because, again, it takes me out of myself. It takes me to other places. But I was trying to think of, A, something that people might not have heard, and, B, something that... would fit into a general kind of a rock lineup. And this is going to sound so pretentious. I really like Mongolian music. Well, I
that
do.
That can't
I love...
not sound pretentious. It's
I know,
impossible.
There's no way of saying that doesn't sound like... but I do. I love throat singing. This gets worse, doesn't it? And the whole guttural thing. And there are some great Mongolian heavy rock bands who mix traditional Mongolian instruments with traditional rock instruments and Mongolian singing. And I've got no idea what they're singing about. And there's a great band called The Who, but it's spelled H-U. And some people might have heard they did do a track on one of the some people might know them because they did do a track on one of the Star Wars computer games.
Right.
But this track is called Wolf Totem. Mm. And they look great as well.
They look like incredible. They just look like crazy Mongolian metalers.
Yes. Mixed with there's a sort of Game of Thrones.
Yeah,
aspect to it, sort of fantasy aspect to it, and you know, so many heavy metal bands, you just think, oh, look at those twats, they can't quite pull it off, but these guys do.
Absolutely,
they look great, and I love the way that they've mixed, as I say, heavy rock with traditional Mongolian instruments and some throat singing.
Yeah. Oh, wonderful. Charlie, it's been such a delight talking records.
That's been
with
great
you.
Fun.
Thank you so much for coming on. And just to remind people, the podcast, they can get it now.
They can get it anywhere you listen to podcasts. Willy Willy Harry Stee, Charlie Higson's History of the Monarchy. And if you want to listen to any of those Charlie Higson and Friends, it's, you know, if you're thinking, oh, I'd quite like to get into classical music, it's not a bad way, because that's really what the show's about, my Scala shows. I'm not entirely sure, but you might have to go through the Scala app to get them.
I did have a listen this morning, so I've definitely got a link for it, so I'll put it in the
show
notes so people can find it. We'll also put together, Charlie, a Spotify playlist of all of the songs that we've spoken about today, so people, if they haven't heard them, can go and listen to them as well.
Fantastic.
Charlie, thank you so much. I'm going to press
stop. It's been my pleasure.
But don't go anywhere.
As if.
That, ladies and gentlemen, was Charlie Higson. I mean, I'm still buzzing. After that, we recorded a little interview for the magazine that I run called Pod Bible, and he was so gracious with his time. When we finished that, we carried on chatting about music and bits and bobs, and it was lovely. And yeah, I've said this so many times on his podcast, but whoever said don't meet your heroes, they got that wrong, because Charlie was an absolute delight. So go check out History of the Monarchy wherever you get your podcasts, and also go check out Charlie Higson and Friends if you like a bit of music chat with some amazing guests, then go head over there and give that a listen as well. In the meantime, anything else you need to know about supporting the podcast and accessing other episodes, just go to the website, which is offthebeatandtrackpodcast.com. I'm back next time. In the meantime, be excellent to each other, and I will see you soon. Much love. Bye-bye.